My name is Jackie Lamport. Today is Tuesday, May 25th. Welcome to the Capital Daily Podcast. Today on the show.
Yes, it takes a lot of savings to buy a house. But this is a bit of the avocado toast argument. Millennials are not buying houses because they're entitled, they're not saving. The data contradicts that. It's harder than it ever has been.
We look at why millennials are being priced out of the Victoria housing market, how intergenerational wealth transfers impacts that, and what the future of the market may look like if this trend continues. Today's Capital Daily Podcast is brought to you by Euphoria Bakery, Victoria's first sugar and grain-free bakery. Find out more at euphoriabakery.co. That's .co. Buying a home in Victoria isn't something that is left on the table for a lot of young people. The purchase of your first home, which at one point was a monumental stage of your adulthood, is now out of reach for most millennials hoping to enter the market. Today we look at why the market is where it is now, how intergenerational wealth transfers impacts the market, and what the future might look like. But before we get to that, we get a sense for where the market is right now. To do that, we spoke to Leo Spatholz, an expert in real estate analytics on the island. In 2019, Leo wrote an article that mentioned Victoria had the lowest millennial home ownership in the country. That was 27.4%. The highest rate in the country for comparison is in Calgary, which has 50%. We ask him why those numbers may be so.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a mystery, this super low rate in Victoria. Some of it makes a lot of sense. You know, you see the higher rates of millennial home ownership in the lower priced markets, but then you also see substantially higher ownership rates in the very expensive markets like Toronto and Vancouver. So it's a bit of a mystery why we're at the very bottom of the list here. It's really important to have some kind of solution for people to get into the homeownership side of things, right? You know, otherwise you're cutting off kind of the first part of that ladder, right? I mean, whether it's a good thing or not, homeownership has been a way to build wealth for people. And basically for the city to have this very low rate, and, you know, partially I would argue due to their own policies and approach to building those homes. I think it's a big problem, right? I think it's going to be a problem for the vibrancy of Victoria in the future.
Leo mentioned how that negatively impacts the vibrancy of the city.
It's, you know, if we're just about being a retirement village, then great. But I think, you know, I certainly have a lot higher hopes for Victoria than that. I think a lot of progress has been made on the economic diversity front in the last 20 years, but that requires people to actually want to and be able to come here to live and to buy a house or even affordably rent, right? I mean, the rental side is the other side of this, but, you know, many people will also want to have the option of purchasing a house.
Leo also pointed out that in general, home ownership in Victoria is on the decline.
So Victoria home ownership rate overall is about 63% as of the last census. So that data is somewhat out of date at this point. It's 2016 data. That ownership rate dropped a little bit from 2011, I believe, just because the house prices got so high and people were forced out of the home ownership market. And currently the census is being conducted, so we'll have new data by next year. And I expect the home ownership rate will drop even lower in the next census data. But if you look at the difference between millennial home ownership rates versus the overall home ownership rates, again, Victoria is the highest in the country. So compared to the overall rate, millennials own the least homes, right, on a percentage basis.
We asked him, since this data doesn't all come down to prices, given that Toronto and Vancouver have higher millennial home ownership, if this could be a result of incomes being less in ratio than some of the larger cities. He said, given the data we do have, as far as we can tell, this doesn't seem to be a factor. But there isn't a lot of data at all that can point us to exactly why this may be the case. So we asked Leo if there was any factor that he could point to confidently.
There's not great data on wealth. There's one issue. It's a bit of a blind spot right now on the data front. That is my theory of why some of these much more expensive markets, or I guess somewhat more expensive markets like Toronto and Vancouver, have a higher millennial ownership rate, even though it's not really reflected in the incomes. I think there is a, those are both global cities. There is a higher degree of wealth floating around. And I think that is allowing some of those millennials to get into the property market, right? Whether it's family money or some other sources of wealth. We just don't really have as much of that in Victoria. At least that's my theory.
Leo also said that he expected to perhaps see more first-time home buyers entering the market during the pandemic as a result of lower interest rates.
I did recently look at some first-time buyer data to see if the pandemic, the drop in interest rates, has encouraged some more first-time buyers to get into the market, and I didn't see it. So the rate of first-time buyers was the same as it was pre-pandemic. It's about 10% of all buyers are first-time buyers.
We asked why this may be.
I think one of the reason is the mortgage stress test did not drop. So if you have some existing wealth, you can take advantage of those low interest rates. If you're an owner already, or if you have a bunch of money for a down payment, great. You can take advantage of that. But the mortgage stress test, so you have to prove that you can pass, pay your mortgage at about 5% interest rate, even though the actual interest rate you're paying is only about 1.5-2%. And so if you weren't able to prove that, you didn't have the income or the down payment to do that, those interest rates do nothing for you.
He also highlighted that the low interest rates may have helped people who already have money save even more.
The low interest rates, I mean, that is a transfer of wealth to people who have the assets already, right? I think it's a massive problem.
We then started to ask Leo about some solutions to the problem. We mentioned a situation in Vancouver where the Squamish First Nation have reclaimed land in Kitsilano. The land is an oceanfront neighborhood near downtown, and their plan is to build 12 towers containing 6,000 units, primarily rental, and offer them at an affordable price. We asked Leo if projects like this could be a part of the solution in Victoria.
Yeah, it could. And I think that the lack of, the really neglect from the government side in building rental properties is a big part of the problems we're facing today. So in the last 30 years, Greater Victoria has added about 2,000 rental properties, purpose-built rentals, and the population has grown by 113,000 in that time. And so, of course, what happens in that case, if government is not providing those rental properties, investors dive into the market, buy up a lot of properties, and then rent them out, right? But we have no one to blame but ourselves for this. And the SNAC development is great because it really shows what is the demand for housing without the impediments of, well-housed neighbors being able to shut it down. Right. So they're building 6,000 units because that's what they think the demand is. And it's a prime location, very close to downtown Vancouver. So I think there may be potential there in Victoria as well. I have no idea if the Esquimalt and Songhees First Nation are considering this kind of thing, but that may be an opportunity, right? How do we build that housing without the constraints right now in getting that housing built?
This brought up the idea of switching to a rental first market. This is what Leo had to say about that.
Yeah, it's tricky and it's difficult to say what is the optimal rate of home ownership, right? Is it 60%? Is it 70%? Is it 50% more like Germany? Hard to say. I think what we have to remember is whatever somebody decides to do, it should be affordable and it should be secure. And right now, if somebody wants to rent, there's not that much purpose-built rental availability. They often have to rent from private investors, and that housing is just not that secure. There's some data that shows 10% of moves in BC were forced. So most recent moves that people reported were forced, either by a landlord or the bank or the government. And the reality is that's mostly by a landlord, right? So if you live in a rental suite that's owned by a private investor, that private investor sells, you're going to get kicked out most likely, right? So
Right.
I think we have to do better on both the rental and the ownership front.
Lastly, we asked Leo about the argument of entitlement. Is it that the market has truly priced millennials out, or is the average millennial just not committed to saving enough for a home?
Yes, it takes a lot of savings to buy a house. But this is a bit of the avocado toast argument, right? Millennials are not buying houses because they're entitled, they're not saving. The data contradicts that, right? It's harder than it ever has been, right? From an affordability standpoint, to buy a house in Victoria. That's just the facts, right? It's not all down to kind of individual drive.
After we spoke to Leo, I wanted to get more information about how intergenerational wealth impacts buyers and the market. So I spoke to Andrew Ramlow, the VP of Consulting Services at Rennie Group. Before we get to that, a quick break for a word from our sponsor. Today's Capital Daily podcast is brought to you by Euphoria Bakery, Victoria's first sugar and grain-free bakery. They're dedicated to bringing you and your family delicious treats that satisfy your sweet tooths without using any sugar, grains, or gluten. Best of all, the ingredients are all things you'd recognize. No fillers, preservatives, or other funky stuff. And they use natural non-sugar sweeteners like monk fruit and stevia that are 100% diabetic friendly. Find out more at euphoriabakery.co. That's euphoriabakery.co. Andrew, thank you so much for joining the show today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So we want to talk about purchasing homes as a millennial. And according to an article in the Globe and Mail in 2021, you estimated that it was close to 90% of millennial homeowners have had help from families to purchase properties. What kind of help are you referring to?
That would be help in terms of down payment for the purchase of a home. So that would be either as a result of a gift from parents or grandparents, for that matter, family members to that first-time home buyer, or some form of loan, just a loan to the kids to actually help them get out of the basement and form households of their own.
How accurate would you say the 90% number is?
Well, this is where I have to sort of digress a little bit. Unfortunately, I'd love to say we've got a really good database of this, and unfortunately, we just don't. The data are kind of wide and varied, and that 90% actually came from a survey that was done from BC Notaries. They had found that 90% of first-time home buyers were getting help with their down payments. And interestingly, they did a similar study back in 2015, and the same question was asked for those first-time home buyers. And the response to say, yes, I got help from mom and dad or from family members, was only 70%.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so a big shift on that front. So that was 2015 versus 2019. They haven't updated to 2020 yet. Our internal data for sales that we have here in the Lower Mainland on the pre-sale side of things says anywhere between 50 and 60% of our first-time home buyers were receiving help from mom and dad. There's also another source. The Mortgage Professional Association of Canada does an annual survey as well. And one of the questions that they ask is, are you receiving help from mom and dad for your down payments? Now, they've come in at between 40 and 50%. Now, that's a national survey as well. So we get people in Woodstock, Ontario, answering that particular question. And we know that the real estate prices are a little bit different out here on the West Coast. So, I would say that if we were able to regionalize that, we would certainly fall above average. But even anecdotally, if we talk with some of the mortgage brokers that we work with, the anecdotal side of things says that it's well more than 50%, and would I don't know if again we would get all the way up to that 90%. But the notaries, they actually surveyed almost 200 notaries in the province of British Columbia, so it's a relatively good sample size, and it seems to indicate that the numbers are going up in terms of the number of kids who are receiving help from mom and dad.
I want to highlight that because you said 2015 the number was around 70%.
Yeah.
And then it went up 20% within 4 years.
20 percentage points, yeah.
Yeah. That's okay. So that's looking at it through a historical lens, then is that even already a lot, like compared to maybe 20, 25 years ago?
Oh, I would say most definitely. And there's a couple of factors that that are sort of weighing in on this right now. We've got a much different demographic context than what we had 20 or 30 years ago. We have a much higher proportion of people moving into the stage of the life cycle where they would be mortgage free. We also have those particular group, that particular group, i.e. the post-World War II boom generation, moving into empty nester stage of the life cycle and retirement. So in a much larger financial position to be able to help out. Interestingly, we also have their kids who are getting into the housing market right now. Mm-hmm. So we've got kind of like, there's this on the demographic side. Yeah, there's a bigger bulk of people, a bigger share of the Canadian or local population aging into those older stages of the life cycle. And they have kids going in. So that could be one of the drivers in terms of the rates going up in terms of helping out. We've also had a little bit of a social shift in that we have seen over the last two decades a growing proportion of kids spending longer and longer periods of time at home, mm-hmm. whether that be remaining in the parental home or like that boomerang generation, them moving back after they do post-secondary. So there's that factor as well. And the third interesting or challenging leg to the school to that stool is just pure increase in housing prices, mm-hmm. which from the first time home buyer side of things makes it increasingly challenging to get into the market. But on the other side of that, that post-World War II boom, they've seen very, very significant increases in the value of their residential real estate, many of which bought in that 20 or 30 year time frame ago, and are looking at that as a potential tax-free windfall with regard to the total dollar value that they have there.
You said something interesting. It was that we're at a point where the boomer generations are at the same time as millennials are getting into the housing market, they are sitting on a lot of money without children. Are we perhaps seeing a moment right now where, because of that, we're seeing millennials who do have the money getting into the market, and that could be driving up the housing costs? And as that period or this like sweet spot starts to go away, are we potentially seeing maybe a return to normal within 20 years or so?
Mm-hmm. Great question. I'm going to say no, I don't think so. That post-World War II boom generation right now is between the ages of 55 and 74. And they've got kids who are entering the market. So, you know, the degree to which this is going to continue, I think it's not a flash in the pan. I don't think we've hit the peak of it yet. So I think that there's a whole bunch of really interesting things that we can talk about relative to that. But the root fundamentals on the demography side are that post-World War II boom, the tailing edge, the largest number, the 55-year-olds, are, you know, sort of just entering that stage where they're hitting empty nesters, getting towards the end of their mortgages, and have the kids who are getting into the housing market. So, you know, I say that this is probably something that is going to persist, and especially in an environment right now where we've seen very significant increases in the last year in the value of that residential real estate, there may be an increasing number of households in the coming years who are willing to help out with the kids in terms of getting them into the market.
Okay. And how much do you think that is what's impacting housing prices? Because I know that, I mean, as I understand it, the biggest thing is just that we don't have the supply to meet the demand. But we're also looking at this amount of people, like this large amount of people who are buying because they have the money, because of the wealth being passed down. And how much is that impacting the market and negatively affecting the people who don't have money coming in from mom and dad?
Yeah, that, again, a super question that I don't have an exact answer to. I would love to be able to say, oh, it's is 10 or 20%. CMHC did a study a good number of years ago that looked at trying to dissect all of the different elements that that are contributing to price increases. And they basically came off and said, like, there's certain things that we can account for, like the change in interest rates or incomes, land availability or supply. But there was this big bucket that was quote unquote unknown. And one of these issues falls into that unknown bucket. So, but all of that being said, another important point on that, though, is I think that some of, while there's a lot of issues on the affordability challenges out there, and I don't disagree with any of them, it's incredibly, incredibly challenging to get into the housing market right now, not just for owners, but for renters as well. But if we just take a really simple example of how some of those common metrics between housing prices and household income have typically or traditionally been looked at, I actually say that some of the way of looking at that is broken now. If I take an example of a first-time home buyer couple, let's say that they go to the bank and they have their 5% down because they've been scrimping and saving to do it. They go in, they meet the bank's financing requirements, and the bank says, that's great, you've got your 5% down, you can afford to go out and buy a $500,000 condo. Okay, great. They can go out into the market. Mom and dad come around and say, bah, you know, we just really, really, really want to get you out of the house. We want you out of the basement so we can go and enjoy retirement and start to travel. So what we're going to do is we're going to give you $100,000 to help you out with your down payment. We're going to get you by that squeaky CMHC insurance thing, and we'll get you up to the level where you don't have to pay that, and it'll help out. So right now, that particular couple has two choices. They can go and buy the same $500,000 condo and significantly reduce their mortgage payments, right? Because they're putting $100,000 more down as part of their down payment. Or they can turn around and say, wow, I'm going for $600K and I'm upgrading to granite and stainless steel in the kitchen. And I'm probably going to say that the vast majority of the first-time home buyers out there are going to opt for option number two. But as soon as they do so, that notion of what they can afford versus what their incomes are is broken. Because now that, it, like on the top side of things, it's that unit at $600,000 with their household income now appears in their traditional equation to be broken and unaffordable. But the reality is that their mortgage payments have not changed at all, because they're still mortgaging exactly the same amount of money. So it's really interesting in terms of the question about what has been driving some of the price increases. Yes, declining interest rates, huge, huge impact. We're at a historic low with regard to where interest rates are. But something that I think also has had a very significant impact at pushing prices forward is this transfer of wealth down into the new generation of homeowners, because it's broken that equation in terms of these traditional metrics of how we look at issues of affordability, which is to take sales prices and average household incomes and stick those two things together. And we just can't do that anymore.
Wow, that's so interesting. I wouldn't have even thought about how that's impacting that. Wow. Okay. Also, it kind of stresses me out to think that people would opt for the higher price one, because if I'm seeing lower mortgage payments, that's the one I'm going for.
Yeah. And you know, but this is where it becomes really, really interesting, because we don't have any really good data on these issues. And if we want to sort of unpeel the onion a little bit more with respect to what some of the drivers are and, you know, what some of the leverage is in the market for those first-time home buyers, and we really need to start asking some of these more detailed questions about things like, well, where are you getting your down payment and how much is that of what the total purchase price is as well?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. You also mentioned very briefly there that this is also impacting renters getting into the rental market even. And I think that a lot of people are looking ahead and thinking, okay, I mean, my generation and me specifically, I'm thinking, I'm not going to own a home. I'm going to be a renter and I'm just going to stay in the rental market. But as home prices and condo prices increase, we're also seeing an increase in rental costs. How much do you think that this is also going to impact people who are looking to just rent?
Yeah, in terms of sort of the wealth transfer, I don't know if it's going to have I can't say what how much impact it's going to have on the rental side of things, but I think if there's one advantage on the rental side of things is there has been a renewed interest in adding purpose-built rental across the country. So not just within our major markets like Victoria or Vancouver. It's the purpose-built rental segment that we do see in terms of the housing starts data has taken up a much, much larger share than it has historically. We haven't built a good significant amount of purpose-built rental across Canada since before 1980. It's an old, old stock, and it's really, really heartening to see that the developers, the provincial government, and the federal government are all moving towards trying to add to that stock. So that's not to say that there's not going to be any challenges for renters in terms of increasing rents. I just think that issues of security of tenure, as well as a new and refreshed stock on the rental side of things, will certainly help out that side of things. And we will likely see the share of our total population who are renters and may continue to be relative to owners increase in time, just as we do see a growing stock of rental within within most of our communities. And that's definitely a good thing. We need a good diversity of tenures, just like we need a really good diversity of structure types within our communities to make housing widely available to a wide range of folks.
This might be, this is out of my expertise to speculate, but I'm still going to ask the question. So if this trend of affordable housing and purpose-built renting does pick up and it is something that becomes more of the norm as opposed to buying a home for a young family or whatnot, are we possibly going to see a drop in price for the houses that maybe a lot of the millennials right now are purchasing at a massive amount of money? Are they going to lose some of their money as the market just kind of stalls?
Well, I've been working in this sector for probably 20 years now, and one thing that I have made a point of not doing is speculating on where housing prices are going to go. just because there's so many factors that are influencing prices. All of that being said, I don't see that there's a ton of upcoming downward pressure on housing prices. And the reason why I say that is you look at whether it be the Victoria region or the Vancouver region, both relatively geographically constrained regions. So it's very challenging to add supply. We add on to that both jurisdictions being a collection of individual municipalities that all have different objectives with respect to growth, and that challenges the supply addition process and elongates it for many respects. In addition to that supply constraint, we have the federal government who last year we welcomed in nationally about 184,000 immigrants. And that was down from what our target was as a result of COVID from about 340,000. So in response to that fallback in federal immigration levels in October, the federal government came around and said, well, we're going to up our targets, irrespective of a relatively slack labor market and unemployment rates that are above, at that point, about 10%. We're going to up our immigration targets from the 340,000 that we thought we wanted to get for this year, 401,000. Next year, 411,000. Year after that, 420. So we are going to see an increasing flow of immigrants into the country, which is definitely a good thing. We've got back to the notion of that aging post-World War II boom, getting into the retirement stage of the life cycle. We need the immigration to fill in for them as they retire out of the labor force. So in addition to the supply constraints that we have in terms of adding housing, we've got growing demand, and that's just from the immigration side of things. There's also all of those really smart Ontario kids like myself who figure that shoveling the snow in the wintertime just sucks and we're going to move westward.
That's what I did.
Yeah, well, I'm with you. I was one of the smart ones, and you as well. So we're also, BC is a big destination for young labor force, whether it be for jobs or for education. And I think we're going to continue to be that. And so on both the international as well as the domestic front, we have this issue of a growing demand. So That's a long way of not answering your question, but to say that I think that the continued supply challenges, as well as what I would see as growing demand going forward, aren't going to result in any kind of longer term crash with regard to housing prices. I would only hope that on the supply side that the federal government starts to match their objectives in terms of increasing immigration with some policies that help the local municipalities as well as the province start to add to the supply and mm-hmm. or reduce the time frame to which the supply is added within our communities.
Okay. I also want to talk about the other group of millennials, and it's difficult to split them into two, but there's the group of people who have help from their parents, and then there's the group of people who don't. How common do you see these people, and how did they do it?
Yeah, you know, really challenging, and I know that anecdotally, again, I can talk about the mortgage brokers and the saying 90% and the notary saying 90%. I think for some of the my younger colleagues, I'd say that it's 100%. So, you know, the vast majority of them are. But yeah, in terms of the ones who aren't, this is where you have to get really creative. If home ownership is something that you do aspire to, some of the banks now are actually doing really, really creative financing on the mortgages where you can get together, you can get a couple of couples together and buy a house. And so you can go co-title on the mortgage and you know, reduce the cost. You can go and buy an astronomically expensive house from, you know, most other Canadian cities perspective. But it may be co-living situation or buying the house to eventually split it up into something that's a little bit more amenable to two households rather than just one. So, mm-hmm. you know, that's to say that it is challenging both for those who may have a little bit of help from mom and dad, but then, yeah, increasingly challenging for those who don't. But if it is something that home ownership is something that you aspire to, you just got to be creative about how you do it. And fortunately, at the federal government level right now, we've just announced this yesterday with some changes to the mortgage lending rules as well. And outside of the exuberance of people to get into the market, both the federal government for insured mortgages and the Office of the Superintendent of Financial Institutions for the uninsured side of things has set a higher threshold for what people need to qualify at, a threshold of the interest rate. And so that does put some downward pressure on people's the level that they're able to pay and isolates them a little bit from increasing interest rates, which we're going to see. We've had the luxury over the last three decades or so of generally seeing declining interest rates, making it more or easier to get into the market. And that being said, 10 years ago, I said, we won't see mortgage rates go down very much more. And 5 years ago, I said, we won't see mortgage rates go down much more. And then we had COVID and, you know, we've got, I've heard of people at mortgages at, you know, 1.59% for a fixed 5-year mortgage, which is a little bit mind blowing in a historical context. So, but that being said, at the national level, they are putting some regulations in place or firming up some regulations that may try and quell some of the irrational exuberance of first-time home buyers getting into the market as well. So I have to look to that as being a bit of a positive sign. But it is a super challenging thing to do. And I'm back to my supply side comments. We really, really need to recognize that we do have a whole new generation of first-time home occupiers, whether they be renters or owners, coming into the market. And that's the kids of the post-World War II boom. And we need to accommodate them. And so we have a real supply constraint issue as well, as I see it.
What can cities and, the provincial and municipal governments do to address the issue? I mean, specifically, I'm thinking Victoria, which is astronomical costs. What can we do?
Well, you can do a couple of things. So from the policy side of things, individual municipalities can work with developers to give them incentives to add units that are affordable. So this is a sort of a traditional development play where the city is going to, it was able to say, well, we're going to give you extra density for a particular development, but what we want you to do is to provide a certain share of your units, either to go to rental or to be rental and subsidized or something like that. So that's certainly one option that that can be done that the cities can use. We also just have to streamline the process. Just in terms of the timeline for what it takes to go from an initial application to keys in the door. So that's something that that certainly needs to be considered. The rezoning approach is definitely, it just adds a ton of time. So some municipalities I know are looking at pre-zoning whole areas of cities to say that, you know what, we're going to upzone a whole bunch of stuff. And if you have an application within that zone, you don't need to go through a formal rezoning and all of the public hearings and rigmarole for that, because we just need to add the supply. So that's certainly another option. Those would probably be sort of the two big ones in terms of trying to get stuff to market. The other side of it, I guess, is tackling some of the notions of NIMBYism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you probably well know, there's a big movement of not in my backyard movement, but a YIMBY movement, a yes in my backyard. And this is, you know, this is the housing cry of the millennial generation. And we talk about a lot about the missing middle here. And I know the term is used a lot, but it's really, really fitting both with respect to the housing forms. You know, like there's certainly the towers that are being added, but not everybody wants to live in a tower. Mm-hmm. And the other end of that spectrum is that traditional white picket fence and single detached house, which we just really don't have the land and space to accommodate anymore. So, you know, let's get stuff in the middle of that. But then it's also the middle demographic. It is you guys. It's not the post-World War II boom. It's not the Gen Xers. It's that middle ground of the demography. It is that millennial generation. So I think that we need to figure out policy-wise how to sort of push down some of those very, very vocal minorities in terms of these issues of not in my backyard and no towers and no densification. And try and figure out how to be creative and work with some of the individuals who may be resistant to some of those changes, and figure out how to get the density into a lot of the older communities. And Victoria is a really great example of that. It's like the west side of Vancouver. There's a lot of single detached homes on big lots that could use a lot of densification. And it doesn't have to mean going in and, you know, ripping down whole blocks of homes. It could mean simple densification with respect to take some of the big old character homes that are in the city of Victoria and let them get split into duplexes or triplexes, even within the same building structure. Mm-hmm. So, and that's, you know, that does unfortunately come with a lot of community resistance depending on exactly where you are. So I think that's sort of another avenue that we need to move down towards as well, is how do we creatively work with some of the apprehensions of communities and that notion of not in my backyard.
What issues arise from only having a generation who can afford to get into the market via their parents?
Well, I guess I would say it's a good question. Thinking about it, probably an increasing share of renters. An increasing share of renters who are staying at home. Who are renting rather than owning. But there's nothing wrong with that. That's just a consequence. You look at some of, in a Canadian context, Montreal has a much, much higher proportion of renters than it does owners, relative to other Canadian municipalities. It's a great city. New York, exactly the same. But you do get those notions from some of the older generation that, who aspired to be homeowners, that, rental tenure is bad, and it's not. There's some amazing cities around that are predominantly rental. So that's probably one of the consequences on that front. You know, ironically, probably the other consequence is kids staying at home for longer periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's that notion of that, you know, the sort of the 20 to 29 year old at home is probably going to transition into the early 30 year olds at home, and now maybe the early 35 year olds still at home. So I think that's probably another consequence on that front. But I think the predominant one probably is just a growing share of that younger generation of householders moving into rental tenure versus owner occupancy.
Okay. I think I could take from that. I mean, Canada culturally for the longest time was a single family home. You don't live with your parents, but sometimes your parents will move in if they're getting old. But there's a lot of other places in the world where it's normal to live with your family and to keep that connection and to keep prices low by staying together. Maybe we'll see a cultural shift.
Well, I can only hope so, but I'd broaden the cultural shift as well. And I'd probably say that I'd love to see the cultural shift move far enough along the spectrum to allow densification of mm-hmm. some of the existing communities. Because, you know, that the notion of the empty nester stage of the life cycle truly is that. And that's, you know, we have lots of households in Victoria specifically because you guys are like a demographic window through which the rest of Canada looks, because you do have an older population over there. And, you know, a lot of those empty nesters are in homes that have empty bedrooms in them as well. Mm-hmm. And so the degree to which we can try and find a better match from a cultural side of things between housing need and housing form, if we can stick those two together to try and incentivize that empty nester generation to downsize and open that housing stock either to redevelopment or just purely open it up to families who can fill the bedrooms up, mm-hmm. We would probably do much better in terms of quelling price increases for a lot of that, the family housing styles.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, thank you so much. This has been really great.
Thanks, Jackie. Anytime, it's my pleasure.
Similar to the themes discussed in this episode, Jimmy Thompson wrote an article about how Victoria could go about increasing density, which could be blanket rezoning. You can read about that at capitaldaily.ca. Do you want to help support Capital Daily's local journalism and connect your business with our engaged and curious Greater Victoria audience of over 50,000? Email our partnerships team at advertising@capitaldaily.ca. Thanks so much for joining us on this Tuesday. If you enjoyed, please share, rate, review, and subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes going forward. We post new shows every Monday to Friday. My name is Jackie Lamport. This is the Capital Daily Podcast. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Thank you.